Welcome to this week's Dial the Cosmos. And on this week's show, we've got a very special guest all the way from Wales. She's a very nice lady who is into a lot of the spiritual things that we're into here on this particular podcast. Debbie Buss, welcome to Dial the Cosmos.
Hi, Dom. Nice to have
Hi, thanks for coming on. It's been a bit of a week, hasn't it? We've
you.
sort of,
Yes.
yeah, it's been quite busy. So tell the listeners a little bit about Debbie. What's Debbie into? What does Debbie like doing?
Oh, gosh. Debbie likes doing lots of different things. Trying to pin Debbie down to one thing
Well.
is that's never gonna happen. I remember my husband always says to me, just pick something, just do something and stick with it. And I'm like, nah. That's not fair. And I think because I love so many different things and I'm curious about different things, I'm always going to be that lifelong learner. And for me, it's at the moment, I would probably say I'm a full-time student. That is my kind of career I am at the moment. But so the heart of me and soul and the bricks and mortar of me is probably my love of astrology.
Okay, so tell me how much is learning a part of your life that has to be there? Is it a really integral part of you?
Yes, I feel it's something that I've always pretty much done as a child. I've always read books, I've always been curious about life, about astrology, about astronomy, about the wonders of, the mystics and the things. And I think growing up having a grandmother who encouraged me with doing all those different things as well. She would often in her garden we would be doing creating these little potions and she would be talking about the fae, the fairies, and then we would talk about the moon and all those kind of things. So I think that's probably why I've always learned and always been curious about things.
So does this mean you're a bit of a witch?
Call that.
Yeah, but I mean it in a nice way at the moment, Debbie.
Yes, I probably am. I mean, I probably wouldn't have been able to admit that centuries ago, but no, there's probably the witch in me.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to be burnt at the stake for missing that. I think you're on safe ground. If anyone's listening on the podcast, without seeing Debbie, Debbie's very normal, red hair. Nothing else, just red hair. And that's, Debbie, she's very straightforward. So your learning process is very dear to you. So what was the last piece of knowledge that you learnt that you can tell us about?
Probably about the recent well, I don't know, kind of I went back to university. Well, I embarked on my university kind of career last September, and I think it was around the time we did the recording for your reading, and I had this almost whirlwind desire to go to university and study, and I did, and I chose Egyptology as my subject. And I loved every part of it. And for the beginning of the year, they gave us a research project. And we had to literally delve into something. And I chose the Queen Hatshepsut. And she was a very remarkable woman. And so I had pretty much a whole year to study her. And that was probably the one of the biggest things I've had to kind of really delve into the academic side of things. And I mean, you can probably see my bookshelf. I've got books everywhere. I do love reading. But for her to get to understand who she was as a woman and as a queen and as a mother, that was, oh my gosh, it just related, not so much as me being a queen, but it really related so much to me as a working mum, as a working mother, and just understanding her and who she was. So that was probably the biggest piece of research. But what I also came from her was understanding the psychology side of it. That is probably my favorite piece of work, is to kind of understand why people do the things that they do.
So we've already established only a few minutes in that you're a witch and a queen. Okay. That's great. We'll see if we've got any more revelations to come as
Well,
the
it is
show goes on.
Leo's season, isn't
So Debbie, who is this queen that we talk about? Who is that lady that you say? Just give her a name check again, just so we know.
it? So she was Hatshepsut. I
Okay.
used to find it very difficult to say it, and I used to, in the end, I ended up calling her H because I couldn't kind of quite grasp her. She was from the 18th, the 18th kingdom, and she was born
Roll
in.
back,
Okay,
18th kingdom. What does that
so
mean?
oh gosh, if we look at kind of probably 1500 BC.
Okay, so a bit before my time. Yeah.
And for her, I don't know if you're familiar of it, but she her body has never been found. Her grave has never her tomb never been found.
Ah, is this the queen that was Tutankhamun's mother?
No,
Grandmother.
she was before Tutankhamun. She her face was disfigured. It was all the statues of her face has been kind of wiped away.
Okay.
Because she was kind of a queen that would dress in a male attire, but she would have the female royal regalia.
Oh.
And so
Oh
there's this,
gosh.
so there's a lot of kind of people kind of go down the gender route with
Yeah.
her. She was slated by so many Egyptologists around the 1800s when they really kind of started to kind of discover who she was, and especially when they discovered that she was a woman. How could a queen of that stature then dress in a male regalia, and then but was also a woman? And
So a sort of Egyptian transvestite.
this I mean, the amount of information out there where people have gone down that feminine route. And for me, when I spoke we had with my lecturer, and I said to him, I don't really want to go down that route with her, because it was so, people have written about her so much that she was kind of like the first, transvestite and all these kind of things. And I'm like, no, that there's much more to her than that. And for me, it was the psychology of her. Why she did the things she did. Why did she dress in that male attire? And I mean,
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about why she was who she was. Because, a lot of people would probably know a little bit about Egyptology, but they wouldn't know about this particular queen. And it sounds very modern to me. It sounds almost like it could be 1980s, 1990s, not.
And I think that's probably why I kind of fell in love with her a little bit, because of who she stood for. Because I mean, when I had my own company, I had a cleaning company, and it was a very male dominated industry, and my hair was blonde at the time because I'm naturally blonde. And I would rock up in my almost kind of like power suit, put my red lipstick on, and I to me, I was going to war. I was, my armor. And I feel that was what she did. It was almost as if she was amongst so many male influence, and especially as she was born into a royal family. So she led the privileged life. She had a privileged life growing up. But she was always dismissed that she would never be queen, because the male would always pass to the male. And when her father died, and she ended up marrying her stepbrother, he was almost kind of made king, and she was kind of like, the queen, but she was never kind of but I always feel with her, she was the woman that was kind of, they say behind every man you've got that real strength of a woman, and I think she was the one that was pushing pushing
Right.
the wheels. And when he died very suddenly, it then fell to almost kind of like the stepson again. So her stepson, but he was only two at the time, so he couldn't rule. So she came in and ruled as queen regent,
Right.
and she took on that role, but she took on that role so well that she eventually became queen. But it's so interesting that she was never named in any of the queen, the list, the king's list. Her name, she was almost kind of wiped from history. And I think it's got a lot to do with, A, she was so respected, but also she was respected as a woman and her strength from it. And yeah, she didn't get the justice she deserved.
Who wiped her? The ancient Egyptians or our historians?
A bit of both. The Egyptians. It was definitely after Thutmose the Third, who kind of, they say that he was so fed up that his stepmom took over his role and things like that. People blamed him. But there's, it's nobody knows who, but the early Egyptologists really slated her. You know, she was a...
So this has got so many similarities to modern day living. It sounds exactly what's going on with our press right now.
And if you think about it, our queen, our late queen, she would have taken on any role in order to serve her nation.
Sure.
And I think that's what Hatshepsut did. She took on, if it meant her wearing a male attire to get the respect that she needed, then she would do that. And I think you would. So,
well, you can look at it, you know, I mean, behind every man's a good woman dressed as a man. You know, I mean, it's...
Exactly.
Yeah, it just goes to show, doesn't it? Nothing ever changes. And I mean, how old is Egyptology? How far back in years? Can you give us many centuries? Are we talking thousands of years here?
Thousands and thousands. And I mean, there's so much about it, Egyptology. You know, for many years it was kind of like the buzzword. Everybody wanted to know about it. They're curious about it. But what I found interesting was the amount of information that is out there actually isn't true.
So it's all made up? All made up?
A lot of it is made up.
By who?
By certain historians, by the media, by whoever. But a lot of it isn't factually true. And I would be, I was lucky enough to, the university that I was in, they had an on-site Egyptian museum, and I got to work in there, so I got to see, you know, the mummies, the coffins, the Book of the Dead, one, you know, the scroll and the papyrus. And I would often kind of say to them, okay, I'm going to write about this, can I just make sure that this is, you know, I am accurate? And they would say, no, don't use that author, that author's not reliable. So that was one of the biggest shocks for me, was like how much information is out there is not factually true.
So are we talking, right, that a lot of the Egyptology stuff that we read in books is just spun for effect?
Some are, yes.
Okay, that's it. So what about the curse of the mummies? Is that something that's just, you know, because that's the first thing that comes to my mind, is this guy digging down, finding Tutankhamun and being told that this place is cursed. You go in there, you're going to die. Yeah?
Yeah.
And he did.
And he did. And I mean, the biggest thing for me researching them was their belief and faith and trust in their gods. And you know yourself, you know, if you have a belief and a faith in something and you hold that dear, sometimes we can manifest it into being. And the Egyptians would wholeheartedly believe that they had a better future, a better life in the afterlife than in their living life. So,
well, this is an interesting subject. So were they into manifestation, first of all?
Yes. I mean, it probably wasn't called, you know, the manifestation, but yes. And people often talk about the Book of the Dead and say kind of like, it's one book, but it's not. The Book of the Dead is basically, they are written on a papyrus, a kind of like a paper, and they are their funeral wishes. So they would put on their... what they wanted to expect of them in the afterlife, what they wanted to bring with them. And each one of them would probably put the little amulets. So they would all have a different amulet of of one of the sacred gods. One of the it would probably be a cat, or they were very much about the animals. They believed that everything had a soul, everything had a living soul, and then they would kind of bring that into their tombs. But mummification was only for the elite as well.
Okay, so let's just break this down because it's a really interesting subject, isn't it? As you may well be aware, Debbie, it's one of those things that the soul has been discussed so many ways in so many thoughts, and it's still only conjecture, isn't it? Nobody's actually said, "Here's a real soul," or given you a jar and said, "This is a soul." Yeah. So no one's actually shown any evidence of it. But the Egyptians, way back all these thousand years ago, were able to think that there were souls and that was part of their rituals. And yeah, and
And what they would do is that, what I found was so interesting was that they would discard the brain. So during the mummification process, they would actually take the brain from the nose, the nasal passage, they would rip it out, and then they would throw it away. To them, it was discarded. There was nothing good about the brain. It was just full of snot.
okay.
And for them, it was the heart. And
Okay.
they kept the heart in. But
Wow.
all the organs would be taken out and put in jars. And these jars then would be buried in the coffins or
Right.
around the tombs.
Okay. I heard the story, and again, if it's there's a lot of spin around stories, I heard the Egyptians used to weigh the person's heart
Yes.
against feathers.
Goddess Ma'at.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah,
Is it?
Goddess
Yeah.
Ma'at. It's
I'm glad
order and chaos. It's all about
okay.
balance, the life of balance. And that's what they believed in, was that everything had a balance and an order to it, order and chaos. So
Yeah.
if your life is out of balance, then that meant that everything else was out of balance. Pretty much what we live and what I probably follow for myself personally, especially as an astrologer, is how to live in balance or try and live in balance and follow the natural cycles. And that's what they believed, was that they had this Osiris, then they would kind of go through all this process to get to the other side.
Okay, so the Book of the Dead is basically a page of a will of what
Yes.
they wanted to take with them.
Yes.
That's interesting. So no book, just
No.
leaflets.
Yeah,
Right, okay.
and I mean, to that, to when you find, when you especially see like archaeologists who actually, and one of the biggest things for me was kind of going through it was thinking, do these people actually want to be excavated? That was the biggest thing that I kind of felt, was, there, some of these are so hidden away, that, and then they had a period where they had grave robbers, so the grave robbers would come in and steal everything. And yeah, so a huge part of me was like, do these people want to be found?
And did they?
Well, that's just I mean, some people say yes, if we hadn't
What
found
do you what do you say, Debbie? What's your considered view on this?
them. I feel sometimes because of when they were laid to rest, they already felt that they were going to be reincarnated anyway on the
Okay.
other side. So that to them, their body was just a vessel.
Okay.
But for me, sometimes I also feel as well that they took so much pride and effort in bringing all their worldly belongings and put them in these tombs away from prying eyes, that they wanted a huge part of themselves to be hidden as well.
So almost like immortality. So
Yes.
yeah. So whatever happened at some point, this time capsule would be opened and people would remember them and who they were.
Yes. And
Yeah.
I think a lot of them, especially when you see kind of like programs on the archaeology and when they find in these tombs and these coffins, you do see a lot of respect as well from them. I have to be careful that, I don't open this, because we're talking about thousands and thousands of years ago. The material is so, it could just disintegrate,
Sure,
as soon as you
sure.
touch it. But a lot of them are also kind of curious of certain curses. So when you said earlier on about, you know, certain curses, Egyptian curses,
yes.
Who knows? I mean, the Egyptians were, if I'm allowed to say it, were nuts. they were a bit crazy.
Yeah, you can say that. I'm sure that there's a few today that are still the same. But the thing that I sort of very interested in is, you know, I mean, we're talking black magic, aren't we? If we're talking curses and hexes, so there's a lot of crossovers here into other parts of the world and other parts of society in different locations that have almost come together with the same way of thinking as the Egyptians had all those years previous.
Yeah.
So there must be some grounding in this stuff, mustn't there? Because
oh, gosh, yeah.
Independently sourced. Because basically the Egyptians ended when the Macedonians came in and took over, didn't they?
Yes.
Yeah. They sort of came in, invaded them and took away their land, and they sort of let them walk in and surrendered very easily without a fight. And then you got all the Greeks and all the Macedonians all living in Egypt.
Yeah.
So it was a sort of a natural progression for them. But they were so spiritual because
mm-hmm.
they had this belief in the stars, didn't they?
Yes. Oh,
yeah,
yeah,
which is right down your alley with the
yeah.
with the astrology, but it wasn't astrology as we know it.
No.
So, do you want to explain a little bit about their astrology and how they would look at things?
They believed in kind of, well, the biggest thing for me that I found interesting was that they didn't believe in eclipses. They believed that eclipses were pretty much a curse, because they believed in such of the moon and the sun god and the moon. So when we have an eclipse and it almost kind of gets enveloped by the sun and the moon, they felt that there was going to be, you know, some catastrophic event was going to happen. And I couldn't find anything about eclipses. And that's what my lecturer said to me, go and see if you can find anything about eclipses, because they didn't believe in them.
Okay, this is, see, now this gets my head going, all right? As you may well know, Debbie, by now. Okay, and I'm thinking there's so much written, which you just said that's pretty nonsense, that they were star travellers. It was the Orion, wasn't it?
Yes.
The star of Orion, and they travelled from Orion. Well, surely if these were space-faring beings that came to Egypt and started off this great big empire that was Egyptian in that particular moment, they would have had knowledge of the stars.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you see how kind of like you go into it and see how the pyramids were constructed, you know, we're talking kind of like, I'm still in awe, you know, how did they do that with the little tools that they had?
How would they?
How? And a lot of it was pretty much bending over the back of, you know, literally pulling these stones, because the limestone was imported, you know, it wasn't something that was naturally, you know, made there. And everything that they used, and they relied so much on the Nile.
Okay.
And especially kind of like the inundation of the Nile. So once a year it would flood. And to them, that was the restorer of life, because it was water and things like that. And then they stopped that. They put the dam in. And so to the Egyptians, it was like this was their life. This was their livelihood. And, you know, they used the mud from the Nile to literally use as mortar for the bricks.
Okay.
And it's just so fascinating, especially when you start to look at kind of the astrology side of it. And for me, that really kind of piqued my interest, you know, for especially the star Sirius, which they called the, you know, the dog star. And that was probably their biggest one that they would kind of believe in. And they had the goddess Nut, which was the night goddess, and then they had the sun, the sun god. So to them, that was that sort of, but they had an idea of, like you said, they must have known what was before.
That's what I'm saying to you. So, eclipse would have been knowledge to them, surely, because they'd have known of the planets and the way the planet cycles.
Frightened of eclipses. They
Yeah.
and if you look back through history, when we have eclipses, there is usually some major event happens around an eclipse.
Okay.
And what they found was there was either kind of a death in the family or a death of the king would happen around this. So they almost saw it as a negative.
Okay, so could it be circumstantial, this stuff? They just drew conclusions, rather like we do today again. It's just there and there. And this building of these pyramids with this sandstone that was not quarried anywhere near where they were made, right? Ancient technology or something else, a bit more?
I mean, some people, there's this story going around, kind of like, the aliens just put this, they just drop these pyramids here, there, and everywhere. But I think because when you read about them and you really kind of understand, try and understand their life, they had so much belief in what they were doing. And that, for me, was the biggest thing that I took from studying them for a year, was their belief and faith in what they were doing.
Right.
And yourself, if when we talk about manifestations or affirmations and things like that, unless you physically can feel it, see it, believe it, to me, all you're saying is just eh. It's just, and there's so much focus on affirmations or say these affirmations, and well, unless you actually physically feel it in your bones and you believe it's true, then it's just eh. And this is what I took from them, was that their undying faith and trust in everything that they did.
Interesting, isn't it? Because the ancient Egyptians may not have had total faith in what they were doing all the time. Can you imagine being an ancient Egyptian working in the hot desert, building these pyramids, and they're giving you beer to drink because the water's contaminated and all the other
Oh yeah,
things?
definitely. I mean,
Yeah.
they had to be watchful of this, of the deadly scorpions. They had to be watchful of the snakes, and they would
Crocodiles.
have these almost kind of, they were called sunia, and they were kind of like medics who would literally be there watching over the people who had stung from scorpions or snake bites. And it was so interesting when I was researching the paper to write about the medical side of astrology, Egyptology, how they used certain items that we still use today, kind of like they had some sort of the aspirin that they would put on, and then they would layer a bite with kind of what we would probably like a bandage or some sort of, muslin paper. They would do the same. So it was very much, a lot of it was stemmed from ancient times that we have kind of adapted into more modern times.
That's fascinating that they might have been the beginning part of modern medicine,
Oh,
although
I definitely
you
feel it.
see that, yeah. So what, how long would an Egyptian live for at that time? What, because I know Tutankhamun was quite young when he died,
Yeah,
wasn't he?
they died very young, and it was usually from certain diseases
Okay.
because of and you have to kind of remember that only the elite, we're talking the kind of the ones that were
Yes.
in the kind of the kings, the queens, those from a royal family or any of their kind of people around them, they would only have access to these kind of medical facilities. If you didn't have that power, then you would kind of like basically just get on with it. But what they
Right.
would do is they would use they would pray to certain gods, and they would have an amulet in their home that they would worship and pray to if anything was kind of illness was brought onto the family.
Right.
And but yeah, most of them died young.
So prayers and affirmations were part of their culture as well. Gosh. So tell us a little bit about the astrology and the and how you came to really be that, fascinated by the way that they studied it.
I think for me last year, I trained and studied in tropical astrology for, oh gosh, over 25 years. That was something. And for people who don't understand, that is kind of tropical astrology is based on the seasons. So it's pretty much kind of 0 degrees Aries, and tropical astrology is also based on a fixed
Okay, so it's
system.
called
Tropical astrology. Yeah.
tropical. Okay.
Tropicals, or it's Western astrology, it's more westernized, and it's based on a fixed system where the wheel is 360 degrees and each section is a 30 degree
Right.
aspect. And it was started around 240 AD when an astrologer, Ptolemy, decided to change from pretty much go in what I study now, pretty much kind of go in where the planets are, where the sun is, where the moon is. They decided to make it a little bit easier and let's do a fixed system. And they got rid of the 13th sign of Fucus. Now, a Fucus is a constellation that sits between Sagittarius and Scorpio. And there are links to a Fucus being the god Imhotep, who was the ancient Egyptian who helped build the Step Pyramid. He was a healer, and they linked it to him, this Ophiuchus, and they got rid of this 13th sign. And when I started to kind of really follow astronomy last year, and there was something within me that felt that to be the best astrologer that I could be,
Yes.
I have to follow the natural cycles of the stars and
Sure.
the planets and where they are today, because there's about a 24 degree difference between the astrology that I do, sidereal astrology, compared to tropical. And once I kind of got that, there was that faith. We talk about that faith and belief and trust
Sure.
in me. There was no turning back. There was no way I could turn back. And I upset quite a few people in my astrology kind of who couldn't understand why, how it was, why I didn't follow them. And I've always said, well, for me, I had to kind of do what was best for me and my clients. Now, there's nothing wrong with tropical astrology. If you're using a tropical system, that's perfectly fine. But for me, I follow where the planets and the sun is. And I think that's kind of piqued my interest. And when I started reading about it and how the Egyptians did exactly the same, they followed the natural cycles. They knew that when Sirius would reach a certain point in the stars, sorry, in the sky, then they would have the annual inundation, the flooding. It was always around July 19, around July. So they
Okay.
always knew that when it would get to a certain point, that's when it would, they would kind of call it their rebirth. So they would
Oh,
have the
that's interesting to me because I happen to know the date the Nile floods. It's just a random bit of information I hold on to. And the Nile floods on the 15th of September every year. Which is
So,
just a random fact.
and there would be four seasons. So it would come in, it would start because Sirius would kind of come in around July, and then it would kind of start, they would know that the next stage would be then the flood,
Right.
because it would come in four sections. They believe they had four seasons. That's what they believed in. And
Right.
that to me then started thinking, okay. And I could never go back. I could never go back to tropical, and I haven't never gone back.
So, if someone came to you, Debbie, and said to you, "I want a reading. Can you do me an astrology reading?" What would they get from, getting you to do that for them? What would they end up with? What would you give them? Would you give them a sheet of information? Would you talk to them? What would they achieve by coming for that?
Each reading is done via Zoom. So we're on a call like we are today,
Okay.
I usually print off their chart in advance, so I have their chart ready. I have started experimenting with actually sharing the chart with some people
That's
when
good.
I've done their reading, so they get to see. Because if you're not familiar with astrology, and I have to rein myself in, because when I start speaking astrology, I can kind of go off on a little bit of a tangent, and these
No.
people are thinking, "What is she talking about?"
Maybe I would have never thought that of you ever.
So I have to kind of say to them before we start, if I go a little bit too fast for you, please rein me in, or please say to you, "Whoa, what did you say?" So I have started experimenting with that, where I'll share their chart. But normally they'll get a copy of the reading, so they'll get the audio copy, and then I'll send them a copy of their chart, and then they get to ask me anything. But they
And
get
what
a
do
slightly
these,
earlier reading.
that sounds great, but what do these charts share? What information? Is it future based? Is it character based? Yeah, what is the information based on?
The software that I use, it's a system that is same as a tropical chart reading. You still get the wheel, but the biggest difference when using the sidereal is that you actually get a fucus. You actually get the 13th sign. So I use a fucus.
Okay.
So what you will find is that everything isn't a fixed 30 degree
No.
angle. So for instance, I have a Virgo rising, and if anybody doesn't even know what that means, that basically means that I have Virgo on the ascendant. But that might take two or three kind of houses. That might go over two or three houses, because Virgo is one of the biggest constellations.
Okay.
It's 49 degrees. So that it would be the difference. So people would look at it and kind of go, "Oh, well, why is that? Why was that sign taking over three houses in effect?"
Yes.
So they get a deeper understanding. I feel, for me, the readings that I do now are, and we talk about the soul, but I do feel that the readings take them on a deeper level. It's not so much a surface reading, because I do take them back into the process of when they were inside their mother's womb.
Okay.
I can kind of see what was going on in their chart. The chart is going to be the same from the moment they take their first breath to the last moment they take their breath. The physical chart never changes. What changes is the transits that happen to everybody on the planet. And what I mean by the transits are the movement of the planets, where they are moving to. And everybody goes through a cycle. We all go through, experience these individual transits, and there's progressions, and there's solar arcs. So there's all these different readings that you can kind of do. And most people want to come to me and find out about a relationship or what's happening with their career. And yes, I can tell them what's going to happen in, say, 5 years' time.
Okay.
Because of the placement of the planets, because I know where they're going to be. But I kind of say to people, well, you have free will. Yes, the chart gives you a flavor of your life. It gives you a little brief insight the moment you take your first breath. But like, Dawn, anything can change. Anything can happen in the split of a moment.
Right.
And you don't want to be relying fully on the chart. Saying,
Okay.
"My chart says I'm going to be
Right.
here." Debbie said I was going to be here, and I'm not here.
See, that's great advice, Debbie, from an astrologer. I love that. That, get a chart, but don't rely on it. It's almost to a point of it's written in the stars. But we come back to the same point, don't we? You have to have faith. So if you get that chart and you don't believe in it, it's you might as well use it for wrapping fish and chips up in, mightn't you?
Exactly.
So
Exactly.
get your charts and get them done with someone like Debbie, who's a brilliant astrologer. Get them done, but believe in them. Don't question them.
Oh my gosh. And I think for me, the biggest advice I can give to people is also get your children's charts read.
Ooh, okay, so what sort of age are you talking about on a children's chart?
I've done newborns. I've done readings for newborns as
Okay.
being given as gifts. I've done,
Wow.
oh gosh, I've done, yeah, I've done very,
So
very small children.
let me talk about this, because this, I'm sure a lot of people will be very interested in this. How far ahead do you make a prediction for a newborn child? How far into their futures do you go?
I don't. And the reason I don't is I can see what is presented in the chart. I can give a brief indication of the personality or the character of that child. Say, for instance, someone was born with a lot of elements in water. So for me, I could even say to that parent or the caregiver, this child is going to have a sensitive nature. This child is going to feel into everything that's around them. And if this child had, say, for instance, it's Mercury, the planet of the mind, in the sign of Taurus, I would say, okay, for this child, use audio or different ways of learning, because they take in information very differently to somebody like me who has it in a fire sign, who can grasp the information extremely quickly, but I don't always retain it.
Okay, I've just had a thought. Okay, and that's rare for me, but and you, well, what it is, right, is I do aura profiles for babies off photographs. Now, wouldn't it be interesting to get people to send their photographs of their children and get you to write an astrology chart, me to write a profile from their energy, so an aura profile, and see if we're actually getting the same results?
Wow, I love
Wouldn't
that. Well, and that is so interesting because I'm just very recently teaming up with a good friend of mine who's a hypnotherapist, June Jemison. And I did her chart reading. And when I was telling her certain things about herself, she was like, how did you know that happened when I was 7 years old? And for her, it was kind of like, wow. For a 7-year-old, she couldn't comprehend what was happening. But as an adult, she was able then to kind of look at it and kind of go, oh, okay,
Okay.
it happened. And we've been doing some things with some of her hypnotherapy clients where the information that I'm finding in the chart is matching with the information that she's picking up from her clients.
We're on a theme, aren't we?
We are. We are.
Because the access to somebody is not just by what they tell you.
No.
Okay, you've learned this. I know this because photographs tell me more than what the person's going to tell me. You know that their birth charts are going to tell you more about them than what they're prepared to tell you. And a hypnotherapist knows nothing. They just do as they're told, don't they? So I hope you're listening. I'm sure she will be. Whoever.
Jane's amazing. She'll listen. She really
She,
can't. But yeah, and I think that's what I kind of got from my fascination with the neuroscience as well, in kind of like how the brain is a pattern seeking machine. It literally goes for patterns.
Yeah.
And if you have something that happened to you as a young child and you're still carrying that energy with you to adulthood, then having somebody like June who can help you almost release that
Okay.
kind of feeling or those negative thoughts. And the biggest thing for me, understanding being in university, was changing my patterns, changing the way
Right.
I was doing things. And if I look at my chart, it was kind of pretty much written in the stars what was going to happen for me.
So
And
let's come back and ask the obvious question here. How would you advise people to change patterns or habits that they get into?
the first thing is to recognize that you actually have a pattern,
Right.
because so many people are unconscious about
So,
it.
no denial, first off.
Yeah, the first thing is you have to get really honest with yourself. And for some people, that is quite difficult. And I had
Okay.
carried a story for me all the way from my childhood, from age 6, that I couldn't do maths. because my father told me that I was, oh, sorry, a big blood lie then. My father told me that I was stupid, and I couldn't do maths.
Did you
So
believe him?
at that time, yes. And that stuck with me for pretty much my 48 years. I thought that has been through my whole life that I couldn't do maths and I couldn't do anything to do with academia.
Well, you could obviously count to 48, so that's, sort of goes against that a little bit, doesn't it? But the thing about parent tapes, or people that tell us stuff, they are misguided. And we actually believe that they're telling us the truth when they're only telling us their version. And we call them out now, don't we? Because we're big enough. But at that time, it's good that, the first principle about being honest with self, looking at
Oh,
self.
absolutely. You have to be honest because, and then I've always said awareness is the key. The minute that you have that observation and you kind of think, oh gosh, yes, that is a pattern within me. That is something that I do. That is that, whether we call it an archetype or that, that negative pattern within me. Once you observe that, the first thing actually, Dom, is getting a reading from me. That's the
Well, let's make it a
first
habit.
thing.
Let's get people in the habit of doing it yearly. That'd be great,
Number
wouldn't
one,
it?
book a reading with Debbie. No,
Every year.
Debbie will do tell you your patterns.
But Debbie who? Debbie
Debbie
Buss.
Buss.
Right. Just make sure. And her website is?
Debbie Buss, truthsidereal.com.
Right. You have to spell that, or you have to actually say it slower.
Okay, so Debbie, DEBBIE, Buss as in BUSS. So it's Debbie Buss, true. Sidereal.com.
Okay, send it to me and I'll put it in the
Yeah.
notes, because I can't say that, and so I'd be wrong to try, but that'd
You
be
have no
there.
Welsh accent, yeah.
Oh yeah, no, you've got to keep your Welsh accent. That's part and parcel of the whole experience. The thing is, when people go away with a chart and with this, they've got a bit of guidance there, haven't they? They've probably been seen for the first time in their life
Yeah,
by
definitely.
somebody who can see them for who they are. There's no hiding.
Nope.
So,
And I don't, to me, I don't see any chart as a negative. I don't see a lot of, there's so much, again, misinformation. There's so much negativity when you read certain astrologers who say a typical planet has this negative, this, and no, I don't believe in that. I just feel that every planet is here to do its job, and we just need to get out of the way of it.
okay. So, let me ask you the obvious question then. Do you read your horoscopes?
Do I read mine only for fun?
So you don't believe in them?
Not always, no.
No?
Because to write a horoscope, you have to do it from a solar-based chart. So basically, horoscope writers write from, so I'm a Sagittarius, so they
Okay.
would put Sagittarius on the first house and they would tell me then what is happening with all the planets around my sign. Now, under True Sidereal, if you were born under a certain constellation, it might be very different to what you are actually being told under tropical. Most people aren't the same sign.
No,
I stayed the sign, but most people aren't.
this is my point, okay? And my point, which I quite often come out with, just to bore people, really, I suppose, is why would people be 1/12 of the population,
Yeah.
or 1/13 on some?
Yeah.
So why would people be in a category the same as the 12 man down? So you count 12, that next person's got the same horoscope as you. Why would that apply? Surely we're individuals within a collective.
Absolutely, and the birth chart shows that we're your, it's gone on your time and place of birth, and the moment you take your first breath, you are incarnate into who you are, and each chart is individual. Even twins, even though they might be born a couple of seconds or a couple of minutes apart, they're still going to have a different experience.
Okay, so do you
Than
believe then, Debbie, it's when you take your first breath that this happens?
I do believe that it's kind of a lot of it is kind of as you're kind of
Not
coming 9 months prior.
in conception, but when you're born or
A
conception?
lot can start in conception, but I
Okay.
do feel that a lot of it, because actually, when I look at a chart, a certain placement in the chart, I can usually tell what was going on with the mother or the father around the time of conception.
Right. Okay. Now, that means that you have an insight into the relationship that they're born into.
Yes.
How would that be? How would you know that stuff? What
For me, it
shows in
didn't
the
come from
chart?
me. It came from a brilliant astrologer called A.T. Mann, who coined it.
Another brilliant astrologer.
another brilliant astrologer, A.T. Mann, who kind of sort of looked at certain aspects on the chart are kind of like are timed. Everything is a cycle.
Okay.
So the first house would represent something between birth to about 7 months. And then it kind of goes all the way around the chart. So if we looked at, say, the eighth house, which is the house of Scorpio, which is also can be sort of the sign of death, rebirth, it could be sort of past secrets. If something was happening around that time and Saturn happened to be in that position, I would usually say, did the mother suffer with some sort of depression?
Right, okay.
And that gives me an indication then, if they answer yes, it'll give me an indication then what is kind of pretty much whether they've inherited a lot of the things through the mother or
Okay.
the father or epigenetics going all the way back to how they incarnate then in this life.
Right. So when you start talking in that way, the first thing I go to is tarot. I'm thinking this sounds like what the tarot is based on. So is tarot based on astrology or is astrology based on tarot?
I would say tarot is based on astrology.
So astrology is the older art
Yes.
and tarot is a much more, what, 13th century beginning?
Yeah, I would say, yeah. And it's so interesting. I could never relate to tarot. No,
Okay.
I did trained in oracles and I did all the readings and I've created oracle decks, but tarot was the only one system that I couldn't grasp and I couldn't get. And a
Is
lot of it is based on a st I don't I think
there a system to get in tarot? I thought the whole idea was there was no system.
with tarot it's a fixed system.
But
It's
is there a
pretty
fix?
much
Is there a fixed system?
I think so in tarot, yes, preferred to an oracle, which can be not as predictive, but tarot is all based on the planets and the signs. Because if you think of the star card is based on Aquarius,
Yeah, sure.
and
It's
Libra is based on kind of the scales, but a
justice,
lot
yeah.
of it, and it's the goddess Mat.
Okay,
If you
so
look.
yeah, so this is where, right, there's a bit of a crossover, isn't there? Because I don't think there's any real system in a pack of tarot. That's what makes them so appealing to people. They can put their own meanings on, right, and they can listen to their guides or their inner self. And they can give readings by how they understand the tarot. So a tarot can be interpreted in any which way you wish, right?
As in any other divination system can be interpreted, even opening in the book, it can be.
Absolutely, absolutely. But astrology is very fixed in what each house means.
To a certain degree, because yes, it could be the first house is self identity, personality. The fourth house is all about home, ancestral patterns, the mother, because it's ruled by the moon and the sign Cancer. But in my readings that I've done, I find a lot of the fourth house archetype is the father or the male energy that is around them. And the 10th house is the mother, which is normally Capricorn, Saturn, and it's linked to kind of the father. And to get a healthy they say a healthy fourth house then is representation in how you present yourself out to the world in the 10th house. But I'm seeing so many different that isn't fixed, that isn't traditional, like you say, that the first house is this, it's linked to this, because the first house is linked to Mars and Aries, but Mars is also the older traditional ruler of Scorpio.
Okay, so what we're looking at and what we're sort of trying to debate is that these systems are interpretations of systems.
Yes.
So we don't know whether our way of figuring things out is the correct way or we're missing something.
Yeah. And I think that's what divination, and I suppose the Egyptians believed in that as well, the divination of it, is that anything is a divination, anything. And for me, if it has a birth date, then I can read the chart. And even down to the point of opening a book and using, say, for instance, a sentence or a chapter from that. That's something that I do. If I need to a question answered, I will often randomly go and choose a book, open the page and see what the guidance is giving.
Do you just want to explain that a little bit? Because this is a great way that people can do their own divination, isn't it?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Yeah. Anything. And this is what kind of pretty much moved me over to my thinking of moving away from Egyptology to move over to psychology, was to understand how the mind works and how to bring in these different systems. And what got me thinking was when I wrote a paper, but my final paper about it was, I go for a walk every morning. And to me, I'm somebody that can't sit still in meditation. My brain is too busy.
I would have never known that, Debbie. Not honestly,
I'm thinking over what's going to happen. You know, I just can't quiet myself. So I got into the habit of literally going for my walk, but I would introduce into my walk some sort of walking meditation. And I would say my gratitudes for, say, the first 20 minutes of my family and friends. And then for the remainder of the 20 minutes of the walk, I would set an intention. So what I do is I will say, okay, I need an answer to this, or something that's happening or something that is challenging. I'll say, okay, I need an answer. And if I don't get an answer or some sort of symbol or symbology happens to me within the next 20 minutes of my end of my walk, I'll go to my library and my book, or I'll just pick up any book that I'm intuitively guided to pick up, and I will turn to the page. And I can't get over how accurate it is that whatever I pick up gives me the answer to my question.
We've got to try this, right? Anyone listening right now, if you've got a problem or you've got something going on in your life right now, you want an answer to it, go and pick up the first book you feel intuitively drawn to, open it up, and your answer will be there in front of you. And you've got to let us know, because what a great way of being able to find the answers. Maybe
it could be one sentence. You know, it could be, you might think, well, my answer isn't there. But you have to set that intention that the answer is going to come, and then remove that attachment to the outcome. So if you literally kind of go, okay, well, let's see. And it could be a word, one word, or you might hear a word on a radio or a song. That is usually the oracles, I call them, kind of giving you an answer.
Okay, well, try it.
Yeah.
Find the evidence.
Yeah, you're interested to find out.
Yeah, it'd be really, really good. Yeah, I mean, I've got a question to ask you, and then we must close up, really. So before
it's
I ask you,
wow.
I awesome. Know, Debbie, you talk so much. Yeah, we go so quick.
I know, so sorry, Dom.
I know, just don't worry. You know, it's made a very interesting and a very, very new, very connected podcast, and I think people are going to enjoy this a lot. So just tell the people or the person that's listening right now where they can actually find you if they want to contact you and just talk to you about astrology or come book a reading.
If they go to my booking page, which is debbiebus.truesidereal.com. There's options to either book in for a reading, or they can book in for a 15-minute call. No obligation, it's free. If they're curious and they want to know pretty much what astrology can do for them, how I can help. And there is lots of information on my site, so they can see that there's lots of testimonials. And there's also a live reading that I did with a friend of ours, Gary Bodley, that I did last year. So they can see how I do a reading, my style that I do a reading. But yeah, no, any question that they're curious and they think, oh gosh, can it help me? Or who knows? Let's have a go. And
get in touch.
Get in touch. And
but nothing to lose, apart from your sanity, maybe, but nothing to lose at all. Okay. Last question time, Debbie. Time. Is it a circular or a linear thing?
Ooh. Now, my gut first response when you said those was circle.
Okay. So why would you say circle?
Why would I say circle? Probably because of time and space. And we don't know what is happening. But yes, it's very linear. But also, I follow a cosmic calendar. So it's not very kind of like the Gregorian calendar. I follow the calendar of the planets. So I look at the moon phases. I work very closely with the moon phases and the timings. And this is probably not even answering your question because I don't really know the answer.
You are right. You aren't answering the question, but it's okay. I'll let you talk because, yeah, I mean, you've just shown me again that you are a witch because you're following the moon cycles, which is fine.
Well, yeah, no, I don't know. I can't ask me another one.
Well, yeah, that's it. That's all I've got. That's it. Yeah, I mean, is it linear or is it circular?
And I think it's circular.
Okay. Well, if you've got a different opinion at home, or if you're listening and you're thinking, oh gosh, no, anyone knows you start at a date, then you finish at a date, and that's it, the end of life. Or if you think, well, we come back time and time again because of reincarnation and it's circular, who's to say? Who's to say? Are we on a big snakes and ladders board, or are we just on a one track out of your line?
Oh, no, I definitely believe in reincarnation.
So it must be circular then, mustn't it? Yeah, time and time again. So, and that takes us nicely up to the close, Debbie, because at some time we'll come back and we'll revisit this all again, won't we? It'd be like deja vu for us.
Yeah, yes. And who knows what I'll be studying next time we come back.
I know, I'm looking forward to that. I'm sure it'll be something like IT or robotics or something crazy, won't it? You know, how to grow house plants in your garden. Yeah, it's going to be something like that, isn't it? But it'll be interesting. Debbie, it's been a really, really lovely conversation. I've enjoyed
Thank
every moment.
To me. I've loved it.
Oh, look, it'll be great. And make sure that you look after yourself until we speak again in a
Thank
year.
You too, Dom. You take care. Bye.